I am going to introduce Brian Walsh. I think anyone who reads Time magazine or follows the blogosphere is familiar with Brian. He is one of the principal writers, thinkers, observers in the environmental and clean economy scene, and he is an avid tweeter. So Brian will come up and introduce the next panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce, for that very kind introduction. And I want to thank Brookings and Patel for putting this report together, because I've been reporting on environmental issues for 4 years now, and I've written I don't know how many stories about green jobs and clean tech jobs and clean economy jobs, and it's nice to finally have a definition and a number I can finally show my editors, because I think they're always slightly suspicious that this could be almost anything or nothing, really. But it does show the sheer size of the clean economy. It's much bigger, I think, than we often realize, and it's also all around us. That was very clear from that presentation. It's not just the kind of sexy jobs, the high-tech shoulder jobs that we tend to write about, but it's mass transit, it's waste management, it's conservation, things like that. And that really shows, I think, both that these jobs are more normal than we think, but also there's a real potential for growth there as well. At the same time, what was sort of touched on in the very end, that last question, I think, about the partisan gridlock that we face now, is that we are at a very important juncture here now. We face a situation where we have a desperate need for high-quality jobs in this country. We're suffering with 9.2% unemployment. And that's on top of the very pressing energy and climate problems that these jobs are meant in some ways to deal with. And we have to worry about energy security. We have to worry about where we'll stack up in the future, because as was clear from before, the United States is very much at risk of falling behind on this area. We see countries like Germany, we see countries like China, certainly, taking this much more seriously, investing from the top down in a way that we've had a very hard time, I think, in the United States. I mean, over the last 2 years, or last few years, we've certainly seen a lot of investment through the Recovery Act, through what we're talking about, what DOE is doing, but at the same time, we face, I think, a concern that there's going to be a cliff, a down cycle, but potentially a really frightening, cliff that we might be falling off of. So with this panel, we're going to really sort of try to get a sense as to where the U.S. is now on the clean economy sector. We'll be talking to some people who actually produce jobs, actually produce products in that sector as well. And we're going to see where in that environment are we really poised to see growth. We talked a little bit before about the policy challenges here. We'll go a little bit more into depth there, both talking about what can be done, I think, federally, but also what can be done on the local and metro area, where I think we see those green shoots of growth really potentially much more perhaps productive than what we might see on the federal level. And then we'll talk really about the need for innovation. We're at a period where I think we need to try something new. We can't necessarily continue the old policies of the past. Especially as the sector grows, as clean energy continues to grow, we're going to see, I think, a limit to how far subsidies can go. We're already beginning to see that actually around the world. You might have seen there was a great piece in Foreign Affairs by David Victor at Stanford about these concerns about this not a coming clean tech crash, but certainly a sense that you're going to get squeezed out in the future. So what can go forward? What do we invest our, quite honestly, limited funds in to get the most bang for our buck? So let me start with the introductions for our panelists. To my left here is Dr. Arun Majumdar. He is the first director of the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, the ARPA-E, which is the country's only agency devoted to transformational energy research and development. He also serves as a senior advisor to Secretary Chu, and he was the associate laboratory director for energy and environment at Lawrence Berkeley before he joined that. To his left, we have Brian Sager, who is the founder and Vice President of Corporate Development for NanoSolar, really one of the most promising solar PV companies out there right now. He manages the company's government programs, strategic partnerships, and the intellectual property portfolio. To his left is Timothy Richards, who is the Managing Director for Energy Policy at the D.C. office for GE. He represents GE on energy policy and really leads a team of GE government policy leaders in D.C. and around the world. And lastly, we have James Rossman, who is Managing Director at Lazard's Power, Energy, and Infrastructure Group, where he heads the firm's global efforts on alternative energy. So Arun, I want to talk with you first. Everyone's very excited about RPE. I love, you know, it's the thing that gets people excited here. When I go elsewhere around the world, they really see that as something that's a truly innovative way to get at some of these problems. So tell me a little bit about what RPE does, what your daily job is like, and what kind of purpose it's serving, why we really need it.
I'm excited too, by the way.
That's good.
First of all, let me just take this opportunity to give my best wishes to Andy Refkin, I think, who is fellow ill, who is going to be here. And so my best wishes to him. Thanks to you, Mark, and your team for doing all the heavy lifting for this meeting and the reports, et cetera. Believe it or not, this is my second public event for the day, so I'm trying to transform my brain and get into this mode now. But RPE was created 2 years ago in the model of DARPA, and it's important to understand the history of DARPA. That was created in 1958 in response to Sputnik, when it was felt that the United States was losing its technological lead, and there was a vulnerability for the nation, and it went on to create things like the Internet and GPS and other wonderful things that you all use today. So no pressure on us. You're supposed to do that for the energy field. And, you know, I believe that we are, and I think a lot of us share this belief, that we are in that vulnerable state. We are importing more than 50% of the oil that we use. We're paying $1 billion a day, and that's a source of our vulnerability. It's a national security issue. It's an economic growth issue. If you could spend the dollars out here, it would be many more jobs. If you look at the grid, for example, or infrastructure, the average age of the assets on the grid are 42 years, 2 years more than the lifetime, and that is an issue. So you look across the whole infrastructure that we have and the technologies, it is a vulnerability. And, you know, Secretary Chu has said this very nicely, you know, when the oil prices go up, we hit the panic button. The oil prices come down, we hit the snooze button. And that's no way to run the United States of America. And so I think this is the time to really invest in the future. And while this is a national security issue, by the way, for the United States, it's a national security issue for China, because they're importing oil as well. It's a national security issue for India and other growing economies. So this is a global market for things. And we need to look at it as a way to innovate, to be able to address not only the United States needs, but frankly, the global market, just with what we did with information technology, with biotechnology and others. We need to do it for clean energy technologies. And it's a massive market, because people are looking for technologies to adopt and to create their own security. So just a few examples. We all know that we are hopefully transitioning a transportation sector, which is a vulnerability, to some element of electrification. So, and that is going on, plug-in hybrid. It's just too expensive. So our way of looking at it in RPE is that let's go for that battery, which does not exist today, by the way, but that battery that'll make the electric cars have a longer range and be cheaper than internal combustion engine cars, so you can sell without subsidies. Okay, so that battery need not be a lithium-ion battery. So we are looking at now, we've created a program called BEAST, Batteries for Electrical Energy Storage for Transportation. Just like you have an Intel inside in most of your computers, we hope you have a BEAST inside in your cars in the future. And this market, again, as I said, it's not just the U.S. market, but worldwide. But to make it to that price point, cost is everything. And, you know, so this, you know, whole class of metal air batteries, including lithium air, lithium sulfur battery, these are really hard, challenging problems. And it's the idea of translating science, what we know about chemical reactions and electrochemical reactions, translate into a device, so the first prototype, which is pre-venture. And that's the area that we are trying to focus on. Solar energy, everyone has access, in the world has access to solar. It's just too expensive to convert that to electricity. And so it's about utility scale, about 3 to 4 times more than what we get from natural gas combined cycle, which is the cheapest, 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Okay, it's just 3 times more expensive. So just like President Kennedy created a moonshot to go to the moon and return safely within the decade, we have now created a sunshot to reduce the cost of electricity from solar to 5 cents a kilowatt hour within this decade. And that needs innovation. You cannot do business as usual. And it is not just the module. It is balance of system, it's power electronics, and other things. So I can go on and on. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that RPE is focusing on, to develop a foundation that will create new industries that perhaps do not exist today. Because that's what DARPA did with the internet and everything else. That's the opportunity we have. And as I said, this is our national security, our economic growth and prosperity at stake, and environmental security. Those are the three securities that we have.
I guess a quick follow-up. Do you, in a venture capital situation, it's a given that most ideas will not pan out. That's part of the deal. Do you feel free to fail in the same way, looking for that one innovation that will really make the difference?
So this is what we do. I mean, the BEAST program that I talked about, we set technology-agnostic targets, okay? So this is double the energy density of today's state-of-the-art lithium-ion battery and one-third the cost. We don't care if it's a banana, and that can do it, okay? So these are, you know, as I said, a whole class of lithium-ion batteries, and there's a competition right now. We don't know which one's going to succeed. But if one of them does, this is a new industry that is created that does not exist. I'll talk about another program called Electrofuels that we created. All the fuels that are developed in alternate way, the biofuels that we talk about, are using photosynthesis, whether it's sugarcane, whether it's cellulose, whether it's corn, whether it's algae. I don't care what you... Today, all biofuels are photosynthetic biofuels. But that efficiency of converting sunlight to fuels is less than 1%, okay? So which means you'll need a lot of land and water. There's sustainability issues, and we need to go down that pathway in order to reduce the cost and make it cost competitive with petroleum-based fuel. What we did in RPE is to create a completely different route of creating biofuels without using photosynthesis. You could do that. You could take electricity from nuclear, electricity from wind or solar, use bugs, which are non-photosynthetic bugs, and there's a lot of biology that's non-photosynthetic. You and I are non-photosynthetic. We are not green. So use the bugs to fix carbon dioxide, use the energy from electricity, fix carbon dioxide, make oil. And people thought this is really risky. Really, this is almost impossible. Well, in a year and a half, people are making oil in the labs now at MIT, at NC State, and other places. And that's the kind of opportunity which, of course, electrofuel industry does not exist today. But if we had not invested and taken the risk, and some, you know, many of them will fail, you know, no one else would. This is pre-venture. Mm-hmm. Venture capital wants to see that first prototype before you invest. Mm-hmm. I'm from the Silicon Valley, so I know exactly what they're trying to do. This is before that, to create the industry, just like TCP that was created in DARPA in 1968. That's when it started, okay? There was no industry of internet that time, mm-hmm. but that's when it, you know, started, and you create the foundation that you create multiple industries out of that. So I think that's where we are.
Brian, I know we talked a little bit before about how NanoSolar is doing right now. It's really, as I said, one of the most innovative PV companies out there. I think, you know, your stuff is sold out for quite a while. You have a better chance of getting a ticket to a Justin Bieber concert than you'd have if you don't already have a reservation for one of your products. So give me a sense of where you are now in the market globally, especially, and some of the challenges you still face as you, you know, continue to grow.
Sure. NanoSolar is almost 10 years old, and like many overnight successes, it's taken that long to get to where we are. From the perspective of what really the early R&D stage was for us, proving out the technology, proving out pilot line processes, proving out the prototype attributes, we were able to access a lot of funding from the federal government, everything from Department of Defense to DARPA funding to National Science Foundation to Department of Energy. So a wide variety of R&D funding mechanisms federally. We had state-level support, and we were also able to raise about $400 million in private equity through four funding rounds. We strongly believe, and I personally believe, that if a technology is promising, if there's a value proposition and it's potentially scalable, that high-quality technology innovation can find funding through ARPA, through DARPA, through other mechanisms. And many of our sister companies in Silicon Valley have also received funding of various sorts precisely along that pathway. The challenges for growth of a company are the scaling framework. And in particular, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to build up a factory. So things like the Department of Energy's Loan Guarantee Program or other mechanisms like that are very helpful. And once you've built that factory and you've got product, you run into a conundrum, which in my view is almost a textbook definition of irony, in that the innovation that excited the early investors, be they the Department of Energy, defense, or private equity investors, the potential for disruptive growth from that innovation is perceived in a risk-averse commercial banking culture as a source of huge risk. So the very innovation which drives the early investment impedes the later investment. And in that later investment mechanism, how do you get past those issues? Well, the more innovative the technology is, whether it's bacteria-driven biofuel production or printed solar photovoltaic cells, it's untested in terms of durability, in terms of the value proposition over the whole value chain in which that product is being played out. Any new product, by definition, has no operating history because it's a new product. So when a debt financing entity comes along to do some project with this new technology or this new innovation, one of the things they'll do is go to a third-party engineer and say, what's the risk associated with this so I can figure out what my debt structure should look like? And the company that's got that innovation says, well, it's a new product. There is no 25, 30-year operating history. And the third-party engineer says, well, I can't assign a risk. And then the debt financier says, well, I can't assign debt. And so our customers then have a challenge. You know, what do they do in this situation? They can either wait, which is what many do, wait until the operating history is sufficiently developed that you've got a statistical de-risk for underwriting of any debt financing for downstream projects, or you can go for pure equity projects, which are statistically relatively rare. And in either case, that slows down the manufacturing ramp up because you are waiting or dealing with a risk aversion, the collision of two cultures, the R&D risk embracement culture and the commercial banking risk aversion culture collide at the exact scale when a company has a new product with no operating history, when that company is trying to become bankable, and that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about debt financing. The other side of the risk, besides the technology, is the balance sheet risk. So you might say, well, I've got a warranty for my product, but the customer might say, well, you are a 10-year-old company and your product warranty is more than twice the duration of your company's history to date. How do I know you'll be around in 20 years? Your balance sheet is such and such, but you know, what is it going to be in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years? So just the scale of growing companies out of the R&D stage to where you have mitigation of both the technological risk from the risk-averse commercial banking culture for bankability, as well as the reduction in risk for balance sheet risk for a company which just isn't at the scale of GE, both of those are really important issues that every company at our scale tackles.
Tim, GE clearly is already a major player in clean tech, and across the entire really breadth of the clean economy, from water to gas to wind, now increasingly to solar as well. Give us a little intro into all those facets, I guess, of GE's role in the clean economy, both nationally but also as it functions in metro areas. I know, for instance, sure, out of that report, you play a major role in the fact that Albany, not the city that will jump to your mind, actually has more per capita clean economy jobs than anywhere else in the country.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. As you say, GE is a long-standing established company, and I think it's important to think about some of the aspects that GE brings to this discussion, because GE, of course, is Thomas Edison's company. So for us, when we talk about innovation, it's truly in the blood. This is a company that was built around innovation, always having the first products, the best products. We were one of the original companies in the Dow Jones, and we're the only one that is still in the Dow that was in the original Dow. And how do you get there? I think it ties directly back to innovation, because if you don't completely commit yourself to innovation and being dynamic and taking risks to make sure that you're transforming the company, you're not staying tied to what you've done historically just because that's the way you've always done it, you won't. It's proven. You can't stay at the top, and you can't stay in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So I think that's an important starting point. Now, I was quite pleased. I hadn't realized that Albany was the top cluster when it comes to clusters, and I do think that that's a really great story because, of course, GE's power and water business is headquartered in Schenectady, New York. That means our wind business in particular is there, the headquarters of the wind business, and we've been adding jobs in that wind business. It's the largest U.S.-owned company in the wind industry, the leading supplier of wind turbines in the U.S. market. We also, though, it's very important, we also have in Niskayuna, New York, also in that Albany cluster, it's where our Global Research Center is located. And so we have hundreds of PhDs doing research much in the clean energy area in Niskayuna, New York. And I think that clearly contributes to the fact that the Albany area is a leader nationwide. Let me just talk about a couple of other metropolitan areas in a way that also highlights the range of work that GE does in the clean energy sector. We view, just as President Obama does, we view clean energy as everything from solar and wind and other renewables through gas, high-efficiency gas turbines, and nuclear energy. And we are the largest exporter of clean energy by that definition, particularly because we export so many gas turbines. Our gas turbines are made in Greenville, South Carolina. We have about 3,100 employees there. We've been increasing employment in Greenville over time, and we've been investing in these gas turbines to make them constantly more efficient and lower emissions. And our most recent investment is actually entirely based around making those gas turbines work with a renewable energy heavy economy. So in particular, what that means is being able to cycle the gas turbines so that they're able to balance load. When you have wind blowing, you can cycle down. When the wind is not blowing or the sun is not shining, you can cycle them up. And it really is a very effective way to keep on increasing the percentage of renewables that you can have on the grid. So that's Greenville. It's Schenectady and Greenville. I'll just mention Wilmington, North Carolina. That's where we have our nuclear business headquartered. We have about 1,600 people in Wilmington. And that's a very heavily engineering-oriented workforce. And we've also been investing in the local community college to help develop the future technicians who can actually fill the jobs that we need to fill, because there are a lot of specialized but not master's degree or PhD level engineering types of jobs that you need to fill. One more business to mention is our water business, based just outside of Philadelphia, another one of the clean energy hubs. Our water business is a membrane and chemicals business, but the membrane is used for water filtration and can be used for both municipal and for industrial applications. So what it comes down to is we've got a really vibrant set of businesses. If you add those all up, it's about $21 billion of total revenue from our clean energy businesses, and it's been growing, and we've been investing here in the United States and around the world. I would say that not all is rosy, and we have to recognize that the clean energy business does depend, just as actually the entire energy business depends fundamentally on government policy. It always has. It's a heavily regulated business. And the fact is that the current impasse here in Washington is raising issues. And one very clear example of that would be for our wind business, where the production tax credit for wind is scheduled to expire at the end of next year. And you already see that there has been a decline in the rate of installation of new wind projects here in the United States, especially here in the first quarter of 2011. It's dropped. So we've got to watch that closely. It's a real challenge, and I think the solar industry could have a similar challenge as tax credits expire there, electric vehicle charging stations. It goes on and on. So careful work has to be done. I know Bruce spoke about the value of a clean energy standard. Perhaps in the next round we can come back to that. But there's a lot of policy aspects that need to be addressed.
Just as a quick follow-up, I mean, we have this feeling, I think, the U.S. is behind when it comes to getting that investment, to deploying that clean tech. Is that the way it looks from where you're standing as well?
Where I'm sitting, I think we are, the U.S. is in very good shape right now in terms of our innovative capability. So I think a lot of the ideas are there. When we've done outreach to take in good ideas in the clean energy space, we get a lot of great ideas from U.S. innovators. The biggest challenge is whether you're going to have the long-term certainty about the market being there. to convert that into investment here in the United States. And that's really important because we have the opportunity to be an export powerhouse in clean energy. But if we don't have a domestic market, you won't be an export powerhouse either. So it actually all really ties together. You will have the growth in China. You will have the growth in Europe in these clean energy areas. But will the U.S. be positioned to take a major part of that? Mm-hmm.
Right. Jim, what's Lazard doing in this field really to help play a role in creating and scaling up these kind of tech firms that we're talking about?
Thanks, Brian. And help is an unusual word to use around banking. But we actually sit in a very...
It's out of the goodness of your heart, I know.
I guess we're the ones who are sort of commercially incentivized to actually go out and find the bankable ideas. And so as a result, we sit in a very interesting nexus point where our job is to go out and scour the country looking for the innovative companies which we think we can match up with the capital that's available, both in the primarily in the private sector, but we can develop good public financing ideas. We work on those as well. And I think I many of the things that we're seeing, and this is, my full-time job is really focused on the U.S., on growth companies. We see a lot of the challenges that the panel is echoing, and we could rapidly, fire them off. It's the, is there really going to be adoption of these technologies? Brian, you sounded like my underwriting committee that we often have to face when explaining why we're covering the companies. The capital required to scale, and it's not just that initial capital to go from being a pilot program to having your first commercial facility. It's really going from that first commercial facility up to your 10 projects as your sales build. And the market is changing every year, and it's rapidly becoming a global market. We've cited China. You can talk about India, Eastern Europe, South Africa, North Africa. It's a rapidly globalizing industry, and in many ways it's very disruptive to the young companies who are trying to play into what they thought was Europe for a while and the subsidized regime there. And they're finding they can no longer just go to a Munich beer hall and sell a lot of solar panels. They now have to get malaria shots and go to places they'd never heard of because these people are putting solar panels in their neighborhoods. And so it's a very different market. So globalization is having a big impact. And there's one theme we didn't speak about on the challenge side, which is that this isn't social networking. This isn't right. Twitter. This is you young companies are up against large incumbents. So a biofuel company is competing against Exxon. Mm-hmm. A solar company is competing against the incumbency issue is a big theme for us. And it often leads, I think, to alternative energy companies thinking about strategic partners a lot earlier than other innovative technologies. On the positive side, what we find very encouraging is the innovation theme in the U.S. I think there's a great deal of innovation taking place in the U.S. right now. But also we're moving into a greater installed base. So you're now seeing a wind market in the United States that has close to 45 gigawatts installed. You have a solar base that's rapidly growing, and you have a global installed base. And so what that means is that we're learning things about these products, and we're also developing ancillary industries, service industries around those businesses. Mm-hmm. We're finding that in wind that actually domestic companies do quite well because the components are large and need to be manufactured locally. In fuels, we're way beyond ethanol. We're into the sunlight-less biofuels now. So we're moving into the second and third generation of products. And as a result, as these businesses scale and new technologies are developed, cost is coming down. So I think we're sort of short-term, given what's going on in Europe, given what's going on in the lack of clarity coming out of Washington, as an alternative energy banker, we're sort of short-term neurotic. But we're long-term bullish about the industry. And I think, though, that the unique challenge is, because this isn't social networking and you need large amounts of capital, is that it's critical that there are policies in support of these industries to help bring them from those very early stages through. Because as Arun said, it's 1 in 100 at the angel stage or his stage, and then it's a 1 in 10 shot at the VC stage. It's got to be a 1-to-1 shot 5 to 10 years later for this industry to survive. And we could talk about the final point I would make is that the diversification of the industry. It's no longer solar and wind and biofuels. It's we're finding very innovative things taking place in the United States around recycling, taking dirty plastic and turning it into, you know, crude at $40 a barrel, taking, you know, wet garbage, doing industrial scale composting in places like Boston and Vancouver, which are really quite exciting developments. And a lot of these guys are technology agnostic and they're process smart. And I think we're going to have a future of alternative energy companies who are quite good around engineering and process. And that's going to help, I think, sort of take the United States to the next level. And it's an area where we play quite well.
Arun, I want to go back to you. Bill Gates and his other heavyweights, the American Energy Innovation Council, and they're suggesting that we spend billions more on R&D when it comes to that side of things. As you point out, you know, we are pretty good at the idea side, but how could we get better? I mean, if you, you know, what are your, you know, your real wish list for improving that innovation system when it comes to energy for America?
I think I agree with everything that has been said. I mean, from where we are in ARPA-E, that has to go to the next stage of the first-in-a-class plant. And that is, as you were pointing out, it is very difficult to get financing because this is not, you know, going to be paying off in 2 years or 3 years like software does. This is going to be longer term, and access to low-cost capital is absolutely key because if you do not have that, you're not going to have the first-of-a-kind plant out here. And that's going to be cherry-picked by other nations as is going on. And once you have sunken costs somewhere else, and if that region has demand, as was pointed out, the next stage of, you know, commercial or pre-commercial plant will be there as well. And we have just lost the access to that technology. And once you have the first of a class in a manufacturing plant going somewhere else, you will likely see R&D going there as well. And that's sort of a bread and butter. So there's a chain effect that could happen, and it's really important to use, as was said, to use the local demand out here to create some demand for clean energy so that some of it stays out here, actually a lot of it stays out here, but also providing the access to low-cost capital to be able to keep the in-between manufacturing out here. So that you really need to look at it as a system. And while RPEs are the really, you know, upstream, you got to look at the whole stream and keep and make sure that we create the local demand as well as the financing out here.
Just a quick follow-up. Are we, I mean, unless there's some kind of pull policy, some kind of guarantee of demand, are we going to keep hitting this problem again? You know, we talked about some of the policy choices out of the report about a clean energy standard. I mean, is that a must, really, if this is going to break through?
Well, I think you have, you know, things like renewable portfolio standards. I think 29 states, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, and varying kinds.
That's right.
And so that's a demand pull. But as I said before, I think I said this, that many of the assets on the grid, for example, are 2 years beyond the lifetime. Mm-hmm. And at some point, there's a vulnerability out there that utilities and ISOs and all will have to address that. And the question is, could we use that demand pull that is likely to come to create those technologies that are not only will be deployed out here, but deployed elsewhere in the world because the grid is growing more as faster than other parts of the world than out here. But we could use our demand to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's the opportunity I think we should make avail of. Some of it is creating RPS and hopefully some clean energy standards. But some of it is just hitting asset walls. Mm-hmm. And it's the reliability of the grid, et cetera, that we could rely on.
Brian, you really, I think, diagnosed the financial troubles that face a company like yours when you're trying to scale up. So what kind of help do you need? I mean, you, again, sort of, if you had that power to make that happen, what kind of system would you craft?
I would balance demand and supply side incentives. The demand side, RPS, clean energy standards are all critical. But in the absence of supply side incentives, you can view the demand side of the United States as an enormous economic stimulus package for Beijing. So if we don't want the U.S. taxpayers to demand products that can't be produced in the U.S. because there's no manufacturing base, we better start supporting the manufacturing base in the U.S. and grow the American manufacturing economy as well. Some very pragmatic things that we can do. One example would be product warranty insurance for new products. These products that have no operating history, the reason that their underwriting of the warranties and insurance products for warranties is so very difficult is precisely because of that lack of operating history coupled to a less than enormous balance sheet because you haven't grown to that scale yet. But the federal government, arguably, may have that balance sheet. So could we have a federal backstop of warranty insurance for new products? And it would look like this. You talk to the insurance industry. You figure out statistically in a particular technology thread how much data they need to be able to underwrite a particular financial product to support the growth of that product and the companies that produce that product. And you backstop the warranty during the period in which that data is being collected. At the end of that time period, you hand it off to private industry. So it's a public-private partnership. In solar, that might look like 3 or 4 years of support federally to backstop a 25-year warranty, but at year 3 or 4, it's now in the hands of private insurance industry who are soothed by the mathematics and statistics of the data from year 0, 1, and 2. So very, very low-cost way to go. We've done a number of modeling exercises and found that the return on investment is anywhere from 4 to 10x, so this pays itself off on an annual basis in a few months. So in an era where we're trying to be fiscally prudent and financially conservative, this kind of policy would be really helpful to kickstart the industry. A perfect place for that would be in a green bank. And folks have asked, you know, is there any federal precedent for this? Yes, there's the crop insurance that the Department of Agriculture has put out. There's the credit subsidy risk insurance the Ex-Im Bank has put out. There's a number of federal programs that have shown effectiveness and return on investment arguments, which we could learn from and develop for the clean energy economy in a way that really would stimulate manufacturing growth in the U.S. The other thing we could do is slightly tune federal policy in ways that make enormous differences for smaller companies but barely impact the federal financing. And what do I mean by that? Well, you may all have heard about this 48C tax credit about a year ago, almost a year and a few months. And there was a lot of, you know, self-congratulations by folks, some of whom are in this room, that this was a fantastic policy because the metric for success was defined as oversubscription. It was 3x oversubscribed, so therefore it was successful. Well, if you travel out to Silicon Valley and you talk to the companies that received those 48C tax credits, no one has been able to monetize a single penny. So why is that? Two reasons. First of all, any company that's building up Factory 1, as Arun's pointed out, or Factory N, is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to do so, and you've got so much operating loss accrued that the ability to use that tax credit directly is several years downstream. The other way to monetize it is to sell it to a third party. Selling it to a third party, you know, has some arcane tax structure, which we needn't get into in this forum, but the critical aspect that was not properly addressed by Congress was the 5-year credit recapture period, and that single term has killed the monetization of the tax credits by any company that's at a scale that really needs them. Because we go to a third party and say, we would like to sell you this tax credit, and the third party will say, well, how do I know you're going to be around in 5 years as a partner if you go away in year 4.99999, the tax credit goes to zero? So the only way I can do the deal with you is if you give me a letter of credit for the full value of the tax credit. Well, that doesn't quite work because not only... So, you know, if the 5-year credit capture period was waived for companies under a certain scale as measured by production output, as measured by revenues, whatever the right metric might be, that would enormously enable already allocated funds in a way that can actually stimulate the economy now. At a more meta level, no one talked to any of us in Silicon Valley about this tax credit before it was structured. So it was a very, very well thought out application process, really looked at greenhouse gas emission abatement, life cycle analysis, you know, financial growth. It was very comprehensive, but it didn't address the operating needs of small companies that actually would use it. So a takeaway message is talk to us.
He's right here, Tim. Tim, I know you have some thoughts on this as well in terms of what, you know, what sort of policy gaps and whether it's green banks, things like that can hopefully solve some of these problems.
Well, first of all, I think I really think Brian's point is a very good one about looking at both supply side efficiency and demand side efficiency. They're both important. And I would add a third part because it sometimes literally slips through the cracks, but that is when we think about the overall energy system, transmission and distribution efficiency. It's an area that we as a company have invested a lot in through our smart grid business, our digital energy business, and we're investing a lot in the software to manage grids that will help make it more efficient. So I think if we think about supply side, demand side, and delivery efficiency, and we really look at the entire package, and we should not just incentivize the demand side, but incentivize the entire system. That's one point. A couple of specific things. Bruce talked a little bit about the recommendation for a clean energy standard. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee has been looking at that idea, has actually solicited public comments on it, and so far has not moved toward legislation. But that's one idea, one way that you would actually be able to put forward a national policy that would actually create the certainty that we've all talked about, the long-term commitment and certainty that we've all talked about. It's not necessarily the only way to go, but it is one of the only ideas that's out there that has been clearly defined or has been somewhat defined and which could provide that basis. So I think that's an element that's really important. Tax credits, obviously we're in a time where everything that scores negatively from a budget sense is under intense scrutiny. But I do think that a lot of these renewable tax credits create way more in terms of total tax revenues than they cost. They probably actually don't really cost anything. And they need to be looked at closely because the negative implications of allowing them to expire without some equally efficient and effective alternative are devastating to everything we're talking about here. And then the last couple of things I want to mention, because the report also does talk about the export opportunities and the fact that building a strong U.S. economy can help us in the clean energy area, can help us become an export superpower. There is legislation on the Hill right now to renew Ex-Im Bank. That actually is extremely important and hasn't really, so far, you know, our clean energy industry hasn't gotten strong enough to do a lot of exporting. But the potential is certainly there, and without an Ex-Im Bank, we're facing competition from other countries that do have export credit agencies, and it would be very difficult. And then, as a general matter, I think there's a lot that can be done with new free trade agreements. There's three free trade agreements that are now on the Hill for approval. All of them actually have good clean energy language in there. It's kind of sprinkled throughout, but they're all actually pro-environmental in many ways. And new negotiations are going on, for instance, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and there's a real effort to look at environmental trade issues in that context. So I think we need to be doing that. Even as we look at our domestic policies, we also need to be looking at how we create the right international environment. Mm-hmm.
And Jim, maybe you could pick up on some of that, too. He mentioned the Ex-Im Bank, what kind of role that can play in getting some of the financing going.
Yeah, I'm glad we brought the theme back to export, which is what Bruce began with, because that's what we see, I guess, in the banking world. We see the U.S. domestic market is really quite nascent, but a global opportunity that is massive and in some ways a lot more mature and forward-thinking in their policies. And the Ex-Im Bank in particular, I think you're right, it's because the domestic base here has been smaller for export, but it is growing. I think if you look at the amount of Ex-Im Bank loans that we've seen over the last 3 years, it's probably doubled each year in the past couple of years, and it's likely to double again in terms of their commitment of capital. It's a relatively small overall asset base, but I can give you multiple examples where $10 million here in a loan guarantee, $20 million there, $50 million really provided some of that bridge capital, not so much at the early stage, but at that second stage of going from commercial plant one up to the next level, at least providing some bridge capital as the technology has improved. So I think the Ex-Im Bank is a really nice model for how that can be done. I also think that we have to do a better job unleashing the private capital. A tremendous amount of money has been raised in infrastructure funds looking for either high single-digit or low double-digit returns. And I don't think we want to get into a debate on the arcane tax policies that have encouraged tax equity to be the financing source for large wind and solar utility-scale plants. But there's something that doesn't seem intuitively right when you're just sort of selling the investment to someone who has a you know, who's getting a tax benefit, maybe completely unrelated to the industry or doesn't have an expertise, versus actually incentivizing infrastructure funds who want to be long-term 25, 30-year-old energy, 30-year energy owners. And so I think there's work to be done on how we harness the private infrastructure capital. And I think there's also costless ways of thinking about our export policy. Many of the alternative energy companies have management teams, and Brian, you can speak to this, who are under a lot of stress just raising capital for their build-outs. For them to have to travel to South Africa 1 week, Bangladesh the next, they don't have the global sales channels of a Schneider's or a Siemens or a GE's. And what we're finding increasingly as we move into this mature or second stage of alternative energy, that not only do they have capital problems, they simply have management problems and resources problems to reach global markets. And I don't know how, I think there may be a policy solution there where you can help channel how people are connecting with these markets, because these are not traditional connections. It's, you know, one, it's selling bio, you know, mass to the UK. It's selling, as I said, solar process skills to South Africa. And there are new channels being built, and the new markets are really those where people haven't thought of, because, you know, solar is great in great insulation areas, and it's not about just where your labor population is. It's where the sun shines best. Wind is in places like the upper Midwest and parts of the world we never thought of. There's tremendous opportunities in Chile where it rains, you know, 1 week a decade, but they have massive mining operations that where, you know, you can sell, you know, renewable energy at 10 or 11 cents a kilowatt hour without subsidy. And so it really takes a different mindset in thinking about what are the new global sales channels that have been created by these new industries, because the sourcing of the feedstock is different than we've dealt with before. And I think government and policy support can play a role. And certainly, I'll go back to the incumbency theme, which I don't think people emphasize enough, is that if you're going to support electric vehicles or natural gas vehicles, you know, there's a big chicken and egg problem. You have to think about whether a single policy statement should be on the table that really, you know, requires or mandates some usage, because when you have, you know, 100,000 filling stations, they're not going to go to EVs or NGVs in, you know, 1 year or 5 years, not even 10 years. It's a big commitment.
Right.
And so I think the incumbency issue needs to get more attention.
We have some time to take some questions from the audience. If you can identify yourself, and if you direct it towards certain panelists, let us know as well. I guess right there first.
My name is Martin Apple. I'm president of the Council of Scientific Society Presidents. I think the future of the country depends on our ability to nurture and capture creativity. And I think as I look across this spectrum, from embracing risk to being risk-averse as we keep moving down the line here, I'm wondering about the future and how do we get capital built again the way venture capital originally was, in which entrepreneurs who had made money started investing it in other entrepreneurs who were trying to start companies, and that was the seed money that built. What we have now in venture capital is mezzanine financing, in which they skip the seed stage because they're risk-averse. And as we're in a down economy, they're even more risk-averse. So what incentives can you see that would rebuild the seed capital for the beginning entrepreneurs, the creative people who we need to nurture?
Sure, Brian.
So when NanoSolar was started, our first 10 angel investments came from 10 successful entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley who all put in small amounts of money. This was in the nuclear winter of funding back in, you know, late 2001, early 2002. So it was a big deal to pull out a checkbook and sign it for any value other than zero. And for them to do that, I think speaks to your point, which is well taken, that entrepreneurs have to help other entrepreneurs from an angel funding perspective. I do think in the Valley that exists, much less so in the rest of the U.S. And I think connecting people from one innovation region to another and really emulating best practices is the way to do that. So folks who might be in the, you know, Research Triangle, North Carolina, need to see culturally how entrepreneurs help each other at the early angel stage. Also, there is a set of venture capital funds which specialize in early stage investments, and they do a superb job at vetting those companies for the kind of risk profiles they're willing to do. But many VCs, as you say, don't specialize in that era. So I think that a lot of entrepreneurs think of venture capital as a monolithic block, but it's actually a portfolio of risks, risk profiles as well. And some venture capital firms have in their mission statement to accept a certain level of risk for a certain expected return, and others are different. And so you need to target, we as entrepreneurs need to target our pitches at the early stages to the venture firms that can embrace that level of risk and have done so historically well.
We have a Twitter town hall question.
Yes, we have a question from Twitter from Taryn Norris from Americans for Energy Leadership. He's wondering, what's America's comparative advantage over China in the clean economy?
Is there one?
Well, there is.
There's several, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, yeah.
Maybe.
Oh, sorry. He's here, apparently.
Discussion about how we need to create stronger domestic markets. I think we can all appreciate that. But we can also recognize the United States will never have as large an energy market as China. So how do we just conceptualize what is the U.S.'s comparative advantage compared to China?
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Let me. I'll take a stab at it and let Jim say some words too. I think, first of all, the U.S., we've just already talked about innovation. So I think you need to start with innovation as the area where the U.S. has tremendous capability. And but I wouldn't finish there. Manufacturing, we do not need to accept that we are not capable of being competitive in manufacturing. In fact, GE, I mean, just looking at our own company, we have actually been investing in additional manufacturing in the United States. We've added about 15,000 U.S. jobs in 15,000 U.S. jobs. 6,800 of them have been in manufacturing in the last 10 years or so. So we're continuing to invest here, and we see the newest U.S. manufacturing as quite competitive globally, or we wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't competitive globally. So I don't think that we should assume that that the U.S. can't be competitive. Our whole previous conversation does lead back to the things that have to be done to be competitive in the clean energy area. But innovating and adopting best manufacturing practices are the two things that we know we can do if we have the markets.
Yeah, it's innovate. The level of innovation that takes place in the United States is multiple times what we see elsewhere. The engineering and process skills here, which I think are increasingly important, and also we don't look at all manufacturing as just a lump. I mean, there's some manufacturing certainly which lower end, commoditized, adds very little value to the overall chain. We're focused on the more complex elements of the supply chain, where really technology innovation, education is quite important, and also you have to think about the pools of capital that are formed in the U.S. You know, there are venture capitalists who have been burned in alternative energy, but it is a very sophisticated venture capital community. There's also a large network of what we call sort of family offices, high net worth groups, which have really who are very focused and are looking for differentiated strategies that we have found quite supportive of alternative energy. I see the Chinese for now are really pretty heavily reliant still on direct government loans and provincial support. They have massive hurdles of their own. The jury is still out in terms of their own efficient allocation and whether they need 80 turbine manufacturers when the rest of the world has decided we really only need about 10, and whether we need hundreds of solar panel manufacturers, whether we need polysilicon coming out of every single town. I mean, I think we are in the first inning of the green economy. That's and exactly. I think, at least from my standpoint, is that I rarely go to China anymore. It's really just traveling around the country to the various centers and trying to identify those bankable ideas to help, as we said at the beginning, Brian.
Sure.
I would say, I mean, the question was about competitive advantage with China. Number one, I'm a recovering professor, spent a lot of years at Berkeley. I would say our system of higher education the university system, the national lab system. We have the head of Oak Ridge National Lab right out here. That is a very, very unique thing. And that is, number one, our competitive advantage. We should not, never underestimate the power of that human capital that we create out here. United States has always in its history, have been able to attract the best talent from around the world. And we should I'm a beneficiary of that. We should continue to do that. Other nations are not like that. And we have always attracted talent out here and unleashed them in this ecosystem of higher education and national labs, et cetera. We have to do that. We have to continue doing attracting talent because there'll be a talent competition at some point. We will never be able to compete with China in terms of number of people. I think that's fair to say. We should be able to compete with them in the number of good ideas. And from my vantage point, I get to see some of the best ideas around the country. I can tell you, I'm extremely optimistic about the ideas that are coming out from universities, startup companies, national labs, et cetera. This is amazing stuff. And we sort of beat ourselves a little bit. Oh, No. We are the best right now. Now, if you look at the Chinese five-year plan, you'll find that they are looking at our playbook and said, we need to focus on innovation. Great. That's great. That's a little bit of competition. Wonderful. And what we should be doing is looking at their market and seeing how do we take this innovation ecosystem out here, unleash that with manufacturing and all, and look at the global market and our local market. So that's the kind of thing that we need to plan out. And if we play our game right, use our own playbook in the right way, we can compete.
Prentip, go ahead.
Innovation is often defined by many of us as the technologies that drive new product creation. But another way America can stay competitive with China and other countries is to have innovation be a central feature of the manufacturing environment. In other words, in China or other countries, how do you compete with a U.S. product? You do it at lower cost with manual labor. Manual labor often leads to lower quality products, throwaway products, and so forth, which are ultimately not very green and they're being used for very short periods of time. So their embedded cost is actually much higher than what they're actually sold for. So having high production volume, low cost, but high quality innovative manufacturing technologies is another way to compete. And at the federal level, if we encourage that, that's very important. There was a program in the DOD called ManTech at one point, a manufacturing technology program that spoke to that. And the DOD today is a very strong advocate of that. In fact, I would encourage whoever isn't from that Michigan entrepreneurial company doing clean foundry development to talk to the DOD and see what you could do for them. I think that'd be a really important funding source. I'm happy to speak with you as well. But the folks that are thinking about innovation purely at the technology level, I think if we can expand that definition to embrace manufacturing, we can stay competitive globally using that same entrepreneurial spirit, using the national labs, using the academic institutions, and really penetrate the cost structure that lets us stay globally competitive on a sustained basis.
We're running a bit behind, so we have time for one more question. Right, I guess down the front.
I'm Sandy Apgar from Baltimore. About the built environment, and specifically ARPA-E, if I have that right, and as an alumnus of DOD, is there a priority, a project, a program for the built environment, and particularly for the process of producing and managing the built environment? We have a huge sector of the economy, roughly 20%, but highly inefficient because of history and policy and structure. And I never thought, frankly, until this morning, that a center of excellence of innovation intellectually in your unit could do for that aspect of the built environment what actually DOD and others have done in other respects and produce enormous breakthroughs if you could focus on wood, on process, not just products.
Well, let me wear my bigger hat than just ARPA-E hat as representing the Department of Energy. I should say, before I even say that, that before I came to the DOE, I, in fact, testified in front of the Senate on exactly this particular issue on buildings and how do we reduce energy consumption in buildings and the built environment as a whole. The Department of Energy has, if you look at the, there's a buildings program that has invested significantly in the R&D, but not just R&D in the demonstration, getting the financing, et cetera, the Better Buildings Initiative. There is, as you know, it is a very fragmented industry in, for the built environment. You needed some, the ability, this is where the federal government can be a convener in many ways. There's a buildings energy innovation hub that is there in Pennsylvania, but it's actually nationwide, but it's based in the Navy Yard in Philadelphia. If you ever get a chance, go there and see what's going on. And you need, you have a microgrid out there, the buildings, et cetera. So there's a lot of activity going on in this area, and it is an area where and it uses 75% of the electricity. So we have to make it much more efficient. In the RPE side, we looked at what the rest of the DOE is doing and say where is the white space, if you may, that the RPE could focus on. And that's a partnership between RPE and the rest of DOE. And we focused on, you know, so we saw lighting program already there that has been covered by the rest of the Department of Energy. We focused on HVAC because that is, you know, heating and cooling is about 40-50% of the building energy consumption. And we found that we are a factor of 10 away from the theoretical limit in air conditioning. And I know we have been using air conditioning since Carrier, 1928. But we said that instead of making incremental improvement in the compressor or the desiccant and things like that, let's take a quantum leap and put the target as the, in a factor of 10, let's put a factor somewhere in between. And we call that program Beat It. Building energy efficiency through integrated thermal devices. So beat the target. And what you get is, you know, you get scientists and engineers excited. So here's a challenge, here's some money, go for it. And you find innovation then. Competition is a good thing in that respect. And we're finding amazing innovation of, you know, removing humidity from air and then cooling it so that you don't have the latent heat load. I won't go into the technical details. But to fair to say, amazing innovation coming out to reduce the energy consumption, to reduce the greenhouse effect of hydrofluorocarbons. This is a huge effect, about 2,000 times more than CO2, the refrigerants. And at cost. The cost is very important. So there's a lot of, so stay tuned in that one. I'll give you more updates if you want.
Okay. I think we learned one thing in this panel is that RPE is great at coming up with acronyms.
That's the Friday evening happy hour.
I want to thank the panel for really a very valuable, excellent conversation. And